Just about 8:34 in the morning, the program's up front. My name is Brian Edwards-Teeker, continuing our conversation with Issa Bloomi. He is a professor of Asian, Middle Eastern, and Turkish studies at Stockholm University, just out with a new book, Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. We'll pick up our conversation with politics inside Saudi Arabia. The person you'll hear him refer to as MBS is Mohammed bin Salman, that country's crown prince and de facto ruler. Back to the interview.
Some of the more recent spats, which seem to be pitting the personality of Mohammed bin Salman against Canada or Germany, for instance, I would suggest are actually reflections of the fact that big Canadian and German companies haven't been paid what they're owed. And this was exposed yet again, one more time, by Donald Trump himself, publicly warning the king of Saudi Arabia that within 2 weeks, the regime would fall without American support. And I would suggest this is a constant reminder to all of us that this facade of a country or a kingdom, if you will, that has the deepest pockets in the world is simply not true.
But it's not just oil revenues. I mean, it has a massive sovereign wealth fund. It's trying to become a massive player in finance.
Well, one would think it is, but if you actually scratch the surface, there's this whole tour of Mohammed bin Salman to raise interest in investing in Saudi Arabia, which has been fallen on deaf ears because people actually know they don't have the resources. They need people to invest in Saudi Arabia like others have invested in Dubai, for instance. They want to replicate the Dubai model, which is to make wealth out of desert sand because they frankly are running out of oil themselves. Aramco, which is supposedly the biggest oil private oil company in the world, owned by the royal family, so to speak. They've been trying to issue IPOs for the last couple of years, but they just cannot convince investors that it's of any value or a value that they expect to get in return for privatizing or putting onto the open market some of their shares. And it's largely because of the oil wells are drying up. It's been well known amongst geologists for a long time now that these eastern oil wells have been far beyond exploited. The attempt to move into Yemen in many ways is to help shore up the long-term assets of Aramco, which then they could use as collateral or indeed just simply add into their claim of reserves that would then make Aramco valuable again.
Okay, so Saudi Arabia's interests, they would like Saudi Aramco to have control of the considerable oil resources in Yemen. Earlier in the interview, you alluded to them being larger than most people realize. What did you mean by that?
If one looks at a geological map in which in most countries, they're broken up into blocks that could be then leased out to companies that does exploration, there's only about 80 to 90 blocks that have ever been allowed by the Yemeni representative of Yemeni governments to outside companies to do extensive research for oil and gas reserves. And in those 80 to 90 blocks, there is a recognized amount of oil and gas. The problem is for the rest of the world that they know that there's enormous amounts of resources that can be tapped into. It just needed the right combination of available credit or capital and the right price in oil and gas to justify the investment. Just to give you one example, Bush Sr., representing Hunt Oil, went down to in 1986 when oil was between $10 and $11 and made an arrangement in which Hunt Oil would have a permanent presence in North Yemen and then eventually South Yemen for developing infrastructure for oil and gas. This was at a time when no one else in the world wanted to touch this still unexplored area, still politically very difficult part of Arabian Peninsula because it just wasn't worth it. And yet they had the foresight and they had the means to actually spin certain kinds of use of American taxpayer money to finance and the entry point for this seemingly small oil company based out of Oklahoma. And that was a long-term investment in Yemeni politics. It was a entry point for American oil companies to get access into what would be considered the next major production zone. And if you include Somalia and the Horn of Africa, which is geologically connected actually to South Arabia, then you begin to realize the extent to which people in this business know that there is an enormous amount of wealth to be produced. Just looking at Puntland, Somalia has basically faced the same kind of trajectory as Yemen. The moment there was a loss of some kind of control in the 80s and in the Cold War, Somalia was broken apart into many fragments. And yet oil companies, whether from Australia or from Italy, have invested heavily in paying local actors to open up their areas, their spaces, to protect their labor, their workers. And they are indeed, in places like Puntland, exploiting huge amounts of what are considered to be multiple billions of barrels of oil in these small geographic spaces. And this extends into Yemen itself.
Right. Okay, so that makes Saudi Arabia's interest much clearer.
And Qatar and UAE for perhaps different reasons and different partners in the outside world.
But there's oil to be had.
Yes.
You need a government in Yemen that is interested in privatizing state resources and bringing in foreign capital in order to take advantage of them.
And more importantly, you actually don't need a strong formal central state, as we're learning with Libya or Syria or Iraq. You can actually have an operation where you can exploit the natural resources, but you just need to make produce conditions on the ground where there is, in fact, no local resistance to this exploitative process. And Ali Abdullah Saleh has served that role for a long time, trying to subdue local resistance. And then when he started to fail in this process, they adapted to these contingencies and started to impose this Hadi solution, and which would rapidly formalize the opening up of Yemen to the outside world's exploitative needs, if you will.
So I guess like one big question I'm left with is why Yemen didn't follow the path of other royal rich nations and create a kind of patronage structures through the state or social assistance programs through the state. You have so much revenue you can capture from the oil. There should be enough that you can buy peace from the population and still have massive profits for the investors.
Well, the extent of the pillaging of Yemen's comparative purposes, it's still yet been tapped into, right? Their oil is still in the ground and still has yet been properly linked up to the global exploitative infrastructure. It was always this kind of treasure waiting in a box, waiting to be tapped into when the resource is elsewhere, which are much cheaper to produce and resource dry up.
I see.
And so when the oil wealth that was being produced from the 1990s onwards, it was distributed to a very small core and of interested parties, some who had formed a coalition from South Yemen, which was traditionally a Marxist, independent Marxist state, which had long had a hostile relationship with the same forces that wanted to pillage its resources. So obviously kept its at arm's distance, these outside oil industry types. And North Yemen itself were very effectively under Ali Abdullah Saleh to balance off, if you will, the interest of outside players with its own survival as a regime. So it played the war on terrorism very well. It played this kind of competition over who is going to facilitate access to Yemen when the outside world starts to seek its considerable oil and gas resources. And the problem is that as politics and the use of money to buy political compliance, at least, which entailed giving considerable amounts of rent to warlords or potential warlords, some of whom are now a very big allies, if you will, in the so-called coalition, trying to undermine and subdue North Yemen's population, especially Ali Mohsin. Mm-hmm. His name is a general. He's very much well-connected with Qatar. And so those types of were the big beneficiaries of the exploitation of Yemen's resources. So they certainly saw no interest in spreading out the wealth beyond their ability to buy compliance and alliance and allegiances from armed civilians. So this was not a central state that wanted to distribute the rent or the wealth of it was producing to, provide some kind of stability to the larger population.
It sounds like you're almost describing a feudal system instead of a consolidated state where the money flows through welfare programs and infrastructure projects and things like that.
The assumption was that the diaspora would be able to fund their immediate communities, take care of their own, and because there was so much contestation, the way that the central state under Ali Abdullah Saleh was able to function was to prioritize the funneling of the state wealth to a small group of people who would be willing to die for this privilege, if you will. And the long-term consequences for the majority of the population was that they were left out of that system.
So let's talk about the divisions within the coalition that is fighting the rebels. You made reference to this earlier in the interview, that Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia are regional rivals. They have separate oil companies that would like a piece of Yemen's natural wealth. How do those rivalries, how do those divisions play out on the ground in Yemen?
So historically, the unification of Yemen made a lot of people nervous in the region because it was a country of considerable human resources, more than even its natural resources. The Yemenis were quite, as a population, quite large, but also very, very dynamic and loyal to each other, and something that had long contrasted very starkly from the neighbors to the north, who relied on a kind of politically passive majority population who did not have access to authority, to any hope of becoming an actor in the regional politics. So you had a lot of Yemenis climbing the social ladders, if you will, not only in Yemen itself, but in the region and the larger world. And so therefore, that it shaped the relationships with neighboring countries. In Saudi Arabia, you had large numbers of Yemenis who became integrated into important families, if not within the so-called Al Saud royal family itself, merchant families in the Hijaz, which is the territory that encompasses Mecca, Medina, and Jeddah, so the western coast of Arabia, which was only captured by the Sauds in the 1920s. So it is, there are many parts of what we call Saudi Arabia which have long historical animosities towards the ruling family. And many of them consider themselves culturally Yemeni, including the bin Laden group. So you had, for instance, Osama bin Laden's father moving to Saudi Arabia and becoming a big conglomerate in construction. And so Yemenis played that kind of role where they were doing the heavy lifting for the Saudi government as it increasingly expanded with the rise of oil prices in the 70s onwards. The same applied to the UAE, who many of the important families married into Yemeni families who had fled 1967, went south Yemen, transferred from being a loosely connected British territory to an independent Marxist state. So all the prominent families that had been doing business with British imperialism for 150 years moved to what was still part of the British Empire, the Trucial states. So Abu Dhabi and Dubai and Ras Al Khaimah and others. And so many of these prominent Yemenis married into local families who became then the ruling families of the UAE. So the UAE, in many ways, sees Yemen as an extension of family. And they had long been able to capitalize on that and did very good business in the 90s and 2000s with various Yemeni interests.
Yeah. We haven't spoken that much about how this is seen within America. I think what's notable in the past year is that a congressional resolution that would have pulled this country out of its involvement with the Saudi war in Yemen passed by an overwhelming margin in the House of Representatives with considerable support from the Republican caucus. What accounts for the sudden cooling of America's political class on war in the Middle East?
Well, obviously, the expose, if you will, the exposure of Mohammed bin Salman, which was once very much a celebrated tour, visiting some, indeed here in the West Coast, he met many of these Silicon Valley types and was championed as the reformer for this otherwise backward medieval kingdom. The kind of cliches that constantly get recycled about the Middle East and especially the Gulf was at play here, in which the hope was to drum up enough interest to actually funnel some of the savings in the United States to help prop up this regime in Saudi Arabia. The problem is that
Mohammed bin Salman, I'll remind our listeners, is the crown prince and de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia now.
That's correct.
And strongly implicated in the killing and dismemberment of the Saudi expatriate journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Who was a long-term propagandist for the Saudi regime and was very much a supporter of the war against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So he was supporting of the creation, if you will, of a very aggressive political Islam project from the 1980s onwards. So it's an interesting element that we need to actually be a little bit more sensitive about, because Khashoggi and the divide, if you will, of the American political and strategic elite between supporting the likes of Saudi Arabia and its kind of old school, extending back deep into the Cold War to a new generation from the 1990s onwards of finding in Qatar a more useful ally in this kind of very cynical use of political Islam against Muslim polities that had remained resilient and resistant to American imperialism, whether it be in Iran, whether it be in Iraq, or in our case here, Yemen. So you see Washington and London very much divided. You have a new generation of political elites in America supporting and embracing Qatar. Indeed, the personal connections between the Clinton family and the Clinton Foundation receiving considerable funds. If one only needs to look at the property markets of London or New York to appreciate the intersections of interest that sometimes clash when it involves the politics in the region like Yemen, where Qatar has a very different agenda than Saudi Arabia, and they actually are supporting very different assets, which in the West ends up being blurred over and they all look the same, as if they're coming from the same perspective and they have the same interests, where in fact they are very much divided. And that's translated also in Western policymaking circles. And so you begin to see a resurgence now of that faction that had been silenced a little bit with the arrival of the Trump administration. And Trump administration has been in itself dramatically transformed over the course of these 2 years, and its political orientations vis-a-vis the Middle East has been shaped by a move away from supporting the UAE, to a lesser extent the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, to again the insurgency of Qatari-backed interest. Mm. And so that will play itself out now in Yemen. Okay. So this effort to somehow rein in United States support for specifically Saudi Arabia does not necessarily mean leaving South Arabia itself. Of all places, Yahoo News has done a report just exposed yesterday, something called the Yukon Yukon trajectory or something like that, where the Pentagon has basically set aside its special operations inside Yemen that will be immune from any kind of congressional pullback of the refueling of Saudi planes in this war. So this public gesture towards, we need to somehow bring this to an end. We need to somehow impose a ceasefire, which is not going to happen, by the way. But it also comes with stipulation that Pentagon's heavy investment on the ground, which is to try to change the dynamics. So there are lots of boots on the ground right now in Yemen. Quite a few American soldiers have died. They haven't reported this. The coalition of Yemenis who are defending their country have very quietly, I think very sophisticated diplomatic way, made it quite clear that they will not expose the extent of American investment in this war in the hope there will be some kind of rapprochement and the ability to actually come back to the negotiation table at some point. Unfortunately, this is a war to the end. This recent call for a ceasefire in 30 days was a very cynical use of time and selling a kind of a new approach from the United States perspective to really give this so-called coalition some time to try to completely isolate North Yemen by taking over this last port of Hodeidah. It's a horrible battles that are taking place right now. But this coalition, which is mostly manned by Sudanese mercenaries, just cannot defeat the Yemeni population. They can't defeat those who are defending their coastline. So we're having yet another period of quagmire, if you will, in this western coast area, which is resulting in horrible civilian casualties, let alone the extension of this siege dynamic, which is threatening millions of people with starvation, obviously with diseases, and this constant use of air power to ruin this country, to destroy Yemen, as was what my fundamental thesis of the book is, that in the end, Yemen is going to be destroyed as an entity. There will not be a Yemen as we knew it for the last 30 years, whatever we end up calling an end to this horrible war. And in the meantime, the struggle between the GCC countries will continue. And it's becoming quite clear that the family in Saudi Arabia is losing control of its assets. Mohammed bin Salman's been arresting his cousins, trying to take their bank accounts away, trying to shore up the, make sure that the flight of all those billions of dollars eventually comes back in order to help keep this regime alive, keep paying the bills, because again, no one's going to accept a check anymore from Saudi Arabia. They have to pay up front for those weapons.
But it sounds like what you're saying is, in the end, if the Saudi interventions in Yemen create a failed state situation, as long as they can buy off enough local actors to suck some wells out of some oil out of Yemeni oil fields, that will be a good resolution as far as Saudi sees its own self-interest.
As long as they can assure that they will not be sabotaged by their two rivals in the GCC, which is the ongoing problem. Right now, there's a more or less an agreement that in certain aspects of this war, they will cooperate with the UAE, but in some, they're in very hostile relations. So you will have proxies fighting each other in Aden, for instance.
And these are largely mercenary forces.
These are all entirely mercenary forces.
Paid by the different Gulf states.
Yes, yeah. If they're lucky, they'll get paid. But what's happening now, we're beginning to see indications of it. There's an Austrian company, for instance, which has reopened its wells and is now shipping oil to the coastline, and there are ships waiting offshore. So they are selling some Yemeni oil. Where that money is going, it's very hard to tell. Obviously, some locals who are facilitating this are getting a cut of it, but it's going ultimately to some other bank account somewhere. An area to look for your listeners is the area called Mahra, which is the far eastern province. They want to build a pipeline that extends from the big oil wells of the so-called empty quarter, where lots of the already tapped in oil is available. And they're trying to ship that to the coastal line, which Saudi Arabia apparently has exclusive claim to, which again will be a big problem because local population realizes their oil wealth and their land is being used to keep up a regime that they have no respect for. So it's playing itself out in increments. There are parts of Yemen's oil infrastructure already being exploited to help finance a war that costs $300-400 million a day for Saudi Arabia, let alone the other actors in the region. So they can't. It's not sustainable. It's been going on for far beyond their imagination. They had thought this would be a very short, easy war, and the fact that this is clearly not going to end, even with the complete encirclement of the peoples in the mountains of North Yemen, means that this war has a whole new life to it in the next couple of months, 6 months. And I frankly don't see the family lasting. If it's Mohammed bin Salman who needs to be sacrificed, which is, you've already heard overtures and suggestions like that, that let's get rid of him, that's not going to resolve the financial dynamic of this war as far as Saudi Arabia is concerned.
Oh. Well, it's a grim note to end on, but that's all the time we have. Issa Blumi, thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you for having me.
Issa Blumi is a historian. He's a professor of Middle Eastern and Turkish Studies at Stockholm University. His new book is Destroying Yemen, What Chaos in Arabia Tells Us About the World. And that does it for today's show. Upfront airs weekday mornings at 7 a.m. Get in touch. Send an email to upfront@kpfa.org. A big thanks to everyone who makes the show happen. Our producer, Corinne Smith. Our engineer, Kirsten Thomas. Hosts are me, Brian Edwards-Tiekert. And soon to return, Kat Brooks. Our intern is Justin Gold. A big thanks as well to Mitch Jezerich and Eileen Alfandary. Stay up and stay tuned. Democracy Now! Is coming your way at 9 o'clock.
Bye.